Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 405 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Lounge managing partner Rick Morris. We have a great conversation lined up for you today. We are pleased to have with us someone who was designated the First Lady of Rock and Roll as she was climbing the ladder of Houston radio and also doing some moonlighting on TV. Subsequently, she combined broadcasting, entrepreneurialism, marketing, instructional speaking, and many other aspects in the career that she has built, and subsequently wrote a couple of books, and I was very pleased to receive these in the mail. I want to thank her very much for forwarding them. Rock to the Top. Additionally, 100 Ways to Rock Your World, Everyday Activities for Success Every Day. And On the Golf Course, 100 Ways to Rock Your World, Improve Your Game One Tip at a Time. It's going to be a pleasure to get to speak with her and also kind of pick her brain a little bit on some of the headlines surrounding the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony and get some of her insights as somebody who has dealt with some of the top rock musicians in the world. Coincidentally, she is the third guest that we've had on from the Houston area, NFL player Vernon Turner and legendary Texans cheerleader Mo Dean being the other ones. But today, we are very pleased and very honored to bring on the show the one and only Dana Steele. And I really want to welcome her warmly to the FDH Lounge. Dana, how are you today?
I am doing great. Thank you for a lovely introduction.
Oh, sure. Well, it was certainly very easy to do with the long list of kudos and accomplishments through your career. And again, you've really built a very interesting and unique career for yourself. I know that's been the foundation for your motivational speaking and your marketing and all of that. And as somebody who, again, really started in the music business since around 1978 being about when you got in there, when did the seeds of a book idea really start to get planted? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't as far back as 78, but along the way, the idea for your first book as you were going through, when did it really start to materialize in your head?
You know, I remember friends, Rick, saying all along, you should write this stuff down, you should write this stuff down. I'm like, yeah, I was too busy doing it at the time to write it all down. And literally got out of radio and started a few businesses, ended up selling my business to a NASA contractor, which got a lot of media attention here in Houston, being a former radio personality. And so people started inviting me to come speak at business luncheons, Rick, and I did. And it was, oh, God, I was awful. They were bored. I was bored. It was horrible. So I remember distinctly, I was at a business luncheon one day, you know, I got on my little business suit, my little business shoes, and giving my little business talk, and I could tell, I mean, you know when you're on stage, you can feel whether the audience is with you or not, and they were so not with me, and I finally just cut my speech short and said, does anybody have any questions? And the sternest looking businessman who'd had a scowl on his face for the entire 20 minutes I'd been talking and arms crossed, very defensive, raised his hand. And I was like, oh, he's going to let me have it. And I said, yes. And he goes, did you ever meet Van Halen? And that's when I realized it hit me. No one could care less at the time what I had to say about business. These were the people that listened to me. He was probably an 18-year-old, you know, guy who used to listen to me on the radio. And I thought, they just want to hear the story. So I started telling a few, yeah, I knew Van Halen. I started telling a few stories, and you could feel the audience, you know, start to perk up, and I started to come alive, and they started to come alive, and they started, you know, did you know Ozzy Osbourne? Did you ever meet, you know, this? Did you ever meet that? It was like such an aha moment. These people want to see the rock chicks that they grew up listening to. They want to hear the stories about the bands that they grew up listening to. They hear business speeches all the time. And I literally did learn a lot from all of these different bands and their managers and their production companies and the people they worked with. And so I started telling the stories that way. And it turned into a book, Rick, and I started coming home and writing stories down. And I mean, it got to the point some days I couldn't type fast enough to keep up with my brain. And I always tell people who want to write a book, and then there are days you sit down and you just stare at the computer for an hour, you know, maybe organize files because you can't think of a thing to say. So that's
right.
That's kind of where it came from.
Well, and I didn't get a hint of this from your books, but I'm wondering if it crossed your head as you were working on them, especially the Rock to the Top book. But, I mean, you would only be human if you did think that. Have you ever had moments of feeling a little bit disillusioned about the fascination that people sometimes have with stuff? I mean, our culture today is so far gone in terms of, oh, okay, I got to go buy this new loofah because Kim Kardashian was tweeting about it. You know, have you ever had moments there of thinking that people sometimes get a little bit too attached to some of these aspects of celebrity life?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, Rick, was to let people know these are business people. The ones I worked with. I do have a confession. My former radio agent, who has remained one of my dearest and best friends, is actually responsible, his agency, for creating the Kardashians. And I tell him every time I see him, he should be ashamed. I'm like, oh, my God, you represent Kim Kardashian and me? That just is awful.
He's got to be a rich guy.
Well, his reply to me was every morning when I get in my paid off Aston Martin, I'm so ashamed. I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Touche.
I think people have always been fascinated. We just have more outlets now. We have, you know, 699 channels on Xfinity, and we have, you know, social media, and so there's so many more outlets. But we were fascinated in what toothpaste Presley used. There's always been that. There's always been that fascination. I mean, look at the girls that screamed over the Beatles, and people went and bought Beatles wigs, and they wanted to know what the Beatles ate for breakfast. And so that's always been there. We just have so many channels to deliver those messages to us. And if you're going to be successful as a band or a speaker or in any business, you have to learn to cut through that noise.
Absolutely, and in recent years especially, social media has been the biggest amplifier of a lot of this. There was another question that I had as I was going through your books and reading them, and again, particularly the Rock to the Top book, because it put me in mind of a conversation that we'd had on the show previously with an all-time legendary executive, Harvey Schiller, and as we were talking about some of the unbelievable folks that he's worked for and worked with, whether it be George Steinbrenner or General Curtis LeMay and Ted Turner and some of them. And he hadn't written a book yet. And I asked him, and I said, you know, clearly, you know, you could do a great management book if you wanted to. Has that crossed your head? And he said, you know, my thought is I want to make sure that I don't betray any confidences. I don't want to put anything out there that they wouldn't necessarily want out there. So what's the thought process like for you as you're going through this and as you're sharing some of these stories and some of these anecdotes? Because clearly, you being a very responsible person, you're not wanting to put things out there into the bloodstream that they wouldn't want out there. So what's kind of your thought process for going through and determining what makes the cut and what should be left private?
Well, you know, the first thing was it was a business book. That was my intention all along, was to let people know that stars like Mick Jagger and John Bon Jovi and, well, not necessarily Ozzy, but he's got a Sharon, they know it's a business. I mean, I've been saying that about Sammy Hagar since 1982. He's and now the rest of the world knows what an incredible businessman he is. They're marketers, they're business people, and they take it seriously. Sammy's up at 6 a.m. doing morning radio, and he goes all day long, and he's involved in every facet, and he does his homework, and he does his research, and he never goes into an interview without knowing something about the interviewer or at least the outlet he's going to be on. And so it had to have positive stories. It had to have stories to show people, yes, it's, you know, it's fun and it's great and it's wild. But just like you, the solo entrepreneur, the small business, these people have to do the same things you do every day. They have to do marketing. They have to be find out what their customers are passionate about. They have to put quality into whatever they release. They have to, you know, they have to get up every morning and say, I got to do it again. How am I going to do it better? What am I going to do better? So that was the original purpose. It had to be business stories. And then you're right. I had to, there were a lot of people that I ran stories past. David Crosby is very open about his past drug use and his prison stint in Texas. And David introduced me to my husband, and that's a big part of my history and my life. Wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for David, but I made sure it was okay with David before I told the story, even though I've told it a lot before I put it in a book. The story of, you know, there's a story in there about Van Halen's manager, who was my, he was my godfather, he was my mentor, he was my everything. But he was wild, and even though he was a great businessman, he was wild. But my agent, who was best friends with Ed Leffler, was the one that, you know, encouraged me to put the story of, I'm the one that got the call in the middle of the night, you know, excuse me, Miss Steele, there's a woman in the lobby. This is in the Four Seasons, Las Colinas, the nicest hotel in Dallas. I'm the one getting the call going, excuse me, there's a woman in the lobby, and she's naked, and she's claiming to be Mrs. Leffler. What should we do? Well, I'm thinking, why are you not calling the road manager? Why are you calling me? I'm just a friend hanging out. And all I could think of to say was, give her one of your nice robes. Just, you know, but that was, I ran that past a couple of people because Ed has since passed away. And so I ran it past a couple of, you know, his close friends, and they were like, oh, by, yeah, yes, Ed would want that story in there. So, and as I like to tell people, Rick, it was the 80s. So a lot of the stories I don't remember. And I know anytime I see you've been tagged in a photo on Facebook, it's like, oh, God, help me. What is it? And I was talking to Earl Slick. Slick plays guitar for David Bowie, and he played with Lennon, and, you know, Phantom Rocker and Slick. And he always says to me, Steele, thank God we didn't have cell phone cameras. I know. So a lot of the stories will never see the light of day as long as my children are alive. And a lot of the stories I can't remember. But, you know, those were the business stories. Those are the stories. And they're not boring, but they are stories that I took lessons from, that I took lessons away from these people.
Well, in terms of how you're describing them, the things that are coming into my mind, you're mentioning aspects of work ethic, of intellectual curiosity that seem to be commonalities between some of them. Are there any kind of surprising commonalities among the most successful rock stars here, anything that you didn't necessarily anticipate but you kept seeing time and time again with some of these characters?
Yes. Well, and I wrote about it in the book, and people always laugh in my speeches. They don't believe me, but these people are healthy. These people are healthy. I remember one night I was standing backstage at an Aerosmith show, and Steven Tyler stuck his head out of the dressing room and said, hey, Steele, come here a minute. I don't know why anybody can't call me by my first name, but they don't. or they would call me kiddo, which, I'm 54 years old. People still call me kiddo. I don't understand, but they do. And, you know, I guess because I'm tiny. But Steven either said kiddo or Steele, come here a minute. And I was in the dressing room for 30 minutes. Well, you know what everybody assumes, and you know the rumors that go around. And, you know, I don't even try to dissuade those. But all he wanted me to do was, remember when you were kids and you would sit on the floor and you put your feet together and then you would seesaw?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to stretch. So I was literally sitting on the floor. He's not a very big person, and I'm not very big either, so I'm the perfect size for him to stretch with. So we would sit on the floor with our feet apart against each, you know, put your feet against your the bottom of your soles of your feet against each other, and you know how you pull to get somebody to stretch. Steven eats the same meal before every show. A couple hours before every show, he eats steamed salmon and steamed broccoli.
Wow.
Mick Jagger, you don't run back and forth across the stage at 70 if you're not running 5 miles a day. And Gene Simmons, never touched a drug in his life, very rarely drinks wine. The man will OD on Diet Coke. That was what surprised me a lot. When Van Halen was on stage and they'd be swigging out of the Jack Daniels bottle, that was iced tea. I hate to burst any bubbles. Yeah, and Sammy Hagar is a huge wine connoisseur. He has a huge wine cellar in his home. But they were healthy. You know, yes, there was sex, there was drugs, there was liquor. But they knew when to stop. They knew when to, I got to get a good night's sleep. I've got to be at an interview in the morning. And that was a real constant that people just don't, they don't realize it. You know, whether you like Ted Nugent's politics or not, the man is staunchly against drugs. If he finds you using drugs on his crew, he will turn you in.
Yes, that's what was known about him. And, again, as far as it goes with Mick Jagger, you know, it's I suppose he need only look at Keith Richards for any kind of a cautionary tale within his own band. As far as
that's one of my favorite titles.
In fact,
the chapter on health is titled "We Can't All Be Keith Richards."
Yes, that was very well titled on your part, and yeah, it's very interesting that it would obviously make that kind of impression on Mick Jagger. Conversely, what are some of the rarer qualities that you've come across? That there's maybe only a handful of really successful rock stars that have it, but it's an element that really helps make them go.
It's their entrepreneurial spirit. Yes, they love rock and roll, but it's about, for anybody who's I call myself a serial entrepreneur. If you know, if you are one, you love business, you love the game, you love the puzzle, you love the successes, and failures have no effect on you whatsoever. You dissect a failure and figure out why it didn't work, and then you move on and try again. That's what these guys have. They have it. They have that. They have that charisma that business people have. They have a innate curiosity, and they're not scared of failure. I mean, think about it. When I was on the radio, you didn't put out a single. You didn't put out just one song on iTunes. You recorded an entire album. And if you were lucky, there was one hit on the album. If you were really lucky, you went too deep. Some bands, very, very few, Van Halen a couple of times, went three deep. But that means there were 7, 8, 9 songs that you slaved over in the studio. No one ever listened to. No one could, you know, everybody could care less. If you play them in concert, people get mad. They have that entrepreneurial spirit that, you know, even if it doesn't work, you keep going and you figure out a way to do it again and make it better. There's a great story about Lady Gaga. Whether you love her or hate her, she is classically trained. She is an amazing musician. She does sing. She has a great voice. She can play all those instruments. And when she found out she had broken, like, all sales records or something, her staff, everybody celebrates, she locked herself in the bathroom and had a panic attack because all she could think of was, but how am I going to get better? What am I going to do next? That's what these rock stars have. That's the same thing that successful entrepreneurs have, is they keep going, they keep learning, they keep meeting people, they learn from their mistakes, and when they do have a hit, they don't sit back and go, wow, I have a hit, and rest on their laurels. That's what happens to one-hit wonders. While everybody else is celebrating, people with a, you know, rock stars with a hit, but at the top of the charts, are already thinking, you know, they're like Gene Simmons. They're already thinking a year down the road, what am I going to do next?
Well, actually, very good anticipation there in mentioning Gene Simmons' name. Of course, the gentleman who wrote the foreword to your book, Rock to the Top. I was going to ask you about that and kind of pick your brain. What do you think when you're reading the headlines these days, based on your knowledge of and friendship with Gene Simmons, all the controversy about who, you know, which members of the original KISS are going to attend the ceremony, who's going to perform with who there. He has taken some shots at so many original bandmates and said they're not fit to wear the paint anymore. So Gene Simmons squarely in the midst of the headlines, as he likes to be apparently at all times. Well, what are your thoughts? What goes through your head when you're seeing your old friend in these latest controversies?
It's all Gene. That's how Gene is. Gene expects loyalty. Gene expects work ethic. And as I said earlier, Gene doesn't tolerate drugs and stupidity. Look at his kids. Look at his kids. They're not in the news. They're not in jail. They're going to college. They're making a living. They're great kids. I say you can really tell something about somebody when you look at their kids. And he's got friggin' amazing kids. But it's because he expects the best. He expects you to work at his level. I had a real problem when I was in radio in Houston with expecting people to be at my level, you know, and expecting people to have my work ethic and my work quality. And I was constantly getting in trouble for, you know, pointing out to people that they weren't working to that level. But now I look back and you know, I'm making a living and I'm doing great, and you know, some of them aren't even in radio or doing anything anymore. So I guess what I'm getting at is Gene can be a little intense and he can be a little hard on people, but at the same time, he expects excellence. And KISS was so iconic even then. And these guys, you know, I don't have explicit facts and figures, but there was not a work ethic that was going into it, and there were drugs, and there were alcohol, and he's a genius. He is a genius businessman. He sees the potential. He sees the opportunity, and it probably drives him absolutely crazy when other people can't see it. I've passed this on to my middle son, my 18-year-old son. I see he has what I have, and that is this sort of sixth sense that you can see what needs to be done to make something work, and you get a little crazy when other people don't see it. You don't understand why they don't see it. But on the other hand, I'm the woman who is best friends with my husband's ex-wife, which drives him crazy, but I think sometimes you have to let bygones be bygones, and they're at the point where they are so iconic, everyone should be included. But Gene so protects the KISS brand. Yes, he wrote the foreword for my book, but you notice there's no KISS lettering. It's not their font. I had to be really careful with their brand in order to use the foreword he wrote for the book. He's very protective.
Very
interesting. That's his baby.
Well, again, I guess it shouldn't be a surprise.
Do you have kids, Rick? Do you have kids?
I do not at this point.
Okay, but
well,
when
that's
you
still,
have a kid,
that's still in
you
the
would,
future. Yes.
When you have a kid, you will lay down your body for your kids. You will do anything for your kids. KISS was Gene's first child.
Mm-hmm.
And he will protect it until the day he dies.
Well, it really makes a lot of sense on that level, and just additionally, it makes sense also that a lot of the most successful rock stars out there would be driven type A personalities who really are compelled to just go the whole nine yards and get the same out of other people. On more of a performance level here, I'd like to ask you a question here just from your sense of having worked in the radio business and having observed a lot of combinations and what works and what doesn't work. Just like to know your instincts on something like the reports coming out of Joan Jett, apparently going to be the front for Nirvana, apparently when they go to perform at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony. Do you feel any kind of an instinct for looking at combinations like that and thinking that might work, that might not work? And If that is the case, if you do have kind of an instinct for that, your instincts tend to be right or wrong more often.
My first thought was, that is amazing. That would be brilliant. Well, actually, my first thought was the F word. That would be effing brilliant, but I won't say that on your radio show because my kids tell me I talk like a sailor. I think it would be brilliant, just like everybody thought it was awful, just awful that Hart, Anna and Nancy Wilson were going to sing whole Lot of Love at Led Zeppelin's induction into the presidential, whatever the presidential hoo-ha awards are, whatever. And I still go back and watch that performance every once in a while, and I get chills or I get tears. So I think when you, I mean, Nirvana was going, they were told they couldn't do what they were doing. And Joan Jett was told she couldn't do what she did. And she has the most iconic rock and roll song of all time. How perfect to put those two together. And there will be Joan Jett fans who are mad, and there will be Nirvana fans who are mad. But think about the background. They didn't just put them together because they were available. Look at the background. Nirvana was absolutely slammed by the critics. Joan Jett was slammed by the critics. Both were told they would never make it. And both, you know, Nirvana's music and album covers are ingrained in our memories. Joan Jett's sound and look and songs are ingrained in our memories. I think it's a perfect pairing. I don't know who else I would have put there, because you're talking about two outcasts and two underdogs who said, screw you, we'll make it anyway. And they did.
It is a really interesting combination. I could see it working. But Nirvana, yeah, you talk about that, about not being critics' favorites. Once they broke through in 91, then it seemed like Rolling Stone and the rest of the world really kind of fell in love with them. I remember reading a pretty infamous review. I think it was in the Washington Post in 91. It was my favorite band, Rush, had just come out with an album, and it was really dismissive of, like, oh, these three old guys should just go away and die. And, oh, this Nirvana is so fresh and new and awesome. And, you know, so it seemed like they got a lot of love once they broke through. What does it tell you about the fact that they're going in the same year as Kiss? Because, obviously, Kiss came on the scene in, what, 74? They've been around forever, and yet they're going in the same year as Nirvana, who's going in their first try. That seems to be almost kind of opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of the respect that Kiss has always gotten from critics and the respect that Nirvana did get once they broke through.
Okay, I'm going to say this, Rick, and then you're going to get hate mail, and then I'm going to get hate mail. But that's what makes for ratings. It helps to die.
Yes.
And I'm sorry. I mean, that's, you know, I'm a businesswoman. I'm a marketing person. I think if Kurt Cobain was still alive, they would not have the chance that they have now. And let the hate mail begin.
You might be
so
right.
There you go.
No, I can see that.
It's going to make people mad, but it's just the way of the world. It's the way we all think as humans.
I almost wonder too, though. I mean, we've spent some time talking about your friend Dean and this sort of unapologetic, unabashedly capitalist approach to everything and just embracing it and being the type A businessman, versus Kurt with the image of the tortured artist and everything that he had going for him there. I just wonder, too, if, you know,
yeah, but
Kurt Cobain isn't playing more of the sensibilities, you know?
Yeah, and he was also surrounded by brilliant business people.
Yes.
You know, he probably
yes.
would have turned into the Mick Jagger of our generation. You know, Mick still does this bad boy, you know. What most people don't know about Mick Jagger is he fired the manager for the Rolling Stones in 1971. He manages the band with a partner. He is the boss
wow.
of a billion-dollar industry. He, more often than not, will help settle the show before they go on stage. I said, that's why he walks like that. He just knows he made $5 million for the night.
Yeah, you know, and Kurt Cobain always had the image of being above it all that he really kind of cultivated, and I just wonder also, too, that's the kind of thing that plays more into the wheelhouse of all the critics and everything. I remember hearing, I don't remember who this was, I think it might have been David Lee Roth that said something like, the reason that critics all love Elvis Costello is because they all look like Elvis Costello. You know, so you know, a lot of these, nerdy rock that's the thing. A lot of the rock critics out there in the intelligentsia that really hoists up Nirvana to where they end up making the Hall of Fame in their first year, it really is kind of a thing of that's what they want to see, isn't it, in a rock band versus Kiss, where they can just be like, oh, they're so commercial. Oh, it's so vulgar that they're, you know, selling, you know, all this merchandise and everything like that. And Nirvana is almost the kind of type of act that kind of sells them more of what they want to hear, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, and I always say BS to that. Nirvana was selling just as many T-shirts.
So, yes.
You know, they were doing the same thing. A great analogy is, I mean, to this day, I play in a lot of celebrity and pro-am golf tournaments now. Not that I'm good. I'm sort of like the plucky comic relief. But I was in a tournament for Wounded Warriors on Monday, and I can't believe how many people came up to me and was like, oh, yeah, I partied with you at Cardi's, and I partied with you at blah, blah, blah. And oh, yeah, that was great. I cannot tell you how many people would call me on a Monday morning and say, oh, man, I partied with you at 3 a.m., you know, Friday and Saturday morning, whatever. And I go, oh, yeah, it was so cool. When I knew, yeah, I did party and I did have fun, Rick, but more often than not, at 9 o'clock, I was at home in front of my TV in my fluffy house shoes because I knew I had to get up the next morning and do a show.
Right.
And yes, I did party and I did stay out late sometimes. But the sheer number of people who said they partied with me, I would be dead. There's no way. So
sure.
When people come up to me and say, oh, yeah, I partied with you all night, I'm like, oh, great. It's all it's the facade. It's the image. It's the brand. Nobody wants to hear that your favorite rock and roll DJ is at home at 9 o'clock in her pajamas watching Dallas or whatever I was watching back then. So you perpetuate the image. So when people, to this day, when people come up to me and say, oh, man, I partied with you so much, I say, oh, I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's
your brand.
Just smile and nod your head.
You protect your brand. It's just like Gene Simmons. You protect your brand.
Absolutely. That brings it full circle perfectly because, again, you have really done a tremendous job of building a brand, of leveraging your experience and the stories and the interactions and the observations that you have accrued over the years and found a way to make it useful and interesting to other people. So as I knew it would be, it was tremendous getting to have a conversation with you, Dana. Certainly love to do it again here on the show. Keep up with you from time to time. Continue to get your observations on the world of music. As I said, wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
All right, just send people to yourdailysuccesstip.com. That's the best way to get in touch with me. And if you want to yell at me about the Nirvana comment, yourdailysuccesstip.com.
Yourdailysuccesstip.com. Go ahead, hit up Dana Steele there. Again, thank you so much for your time, Dana. Love to do it again with you on the program here. Thank you. Have a great day. All right, everyone, thank you all for tuning in to mini episode number 405 of the FDH Lounge.